Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History. I'm just standing on the bridge of a boat, of a ship, looking out on a perfectly smooth mirror-like surface of the sea as the moon rises over there in the on the southeast horizon. I'm here during lockdown, doing some social isolation on a big boat in the middle of the ocean by myself. This episode of the History Hit podcast has got nothing whatsoever to do with maritime affairs. In fact, it's very land-based. We got Damien Lewis back on the podcast. That historian just writes one best-selling smash hit about special forces in World War II after another. Well, he's only gone and done it again. This time he got a tip-off from a member of the public, one of his fans, via social media. He got a tip-off, he looked into it, he pulled on that thread, and what do you know, there's another extraordinary story from the Second World War of what the special forces, the SAS, were getting up to after D-Day in France. It's a story of bravery, capture, luck, escape, revenge, heroism, you name it. It's got it all. You're going to absolutely love it. It's great to have Damien back on the podcast. Hundreds of you have entered our competition for £100 to spend in the shop. Please go to historyhit.com/quiz. It's all self-explanatory. There you get £100 and you can check out the absolutely bizarre History Hit shop while you're there. We're already running low on woolly medieval helmets with retractable face coverings. It's proving the absolute hot item on the shop this season. But in the meantime, everyone, enjoy this podcast with Damien Lewis. Damien, great to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you. It's always good to be on the show, and glad it's still all going, all bells and whistles, in this very difficult time we're all living through.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I just want to, well done to you as well. Just when you think there are no more stories to be told about special forces in the Second World War, here's this one. You've got a true Band of Brothers tale.
Yeah, it's a hell of a story. And the way it came to me is, you know, one of those kind of unbelievable tales. It was a message over Facebook, a guy called James Irvin, who is a former military guy himself, but his grandfather, Trooper Packman, served in the SAS during the war. And he just sent me a quick message saying, look, you know, my grandfather was killed on SAS operations in France post D-Day. He was captured by the Gestapo and, you know, brutally put to death. And it's part of a wider story about these incredible missions deep behind the lines, directly in the aftermath of D-Day, to try to stop German armour getting to the D-Day beaches. Might be of interest. And so from there, I started looking into it. And then, as you say, it just became this absolutely extraordinary tale, which lasts from, you know, June 1944, all the way through again to the Nazi hunting operations post-war. So right the way through to 1947, you know, one of those really incredible tales where you follow these characters through just the most extraordinary missions and escapes, and then, of course, the quest for vengeance and justice.
So you mentioned the mission after D-Day. I mean, you don't hear as much about special forces in summer of 1944, partly because it's a war of big battalions, it's a war of armoured divisions, things like that. But what was their job in France in the second half of 1944?
They'd only ever existed overseas. So they formed in North Africa, then fought all through the North African campaign, and then, of course, you know, the Mediterranean in Italy. And they were called back to Britain for the first time in late 43, early 44. And they were headquartered in Darvel in Scotland. And their mission was to get themselves in shape and undergo a massive recruitment drive to support the D-Day landings. So they came back to the UK, this piratical band of raiders, as they were described, with every conceivable nationality in their ranks and lots of eclectic collections of uniforms, and it didn't particularly go down very well. And as high command tried to drag them kicking and screaming into line, spit and polish and tried to get them doing a bit of drill and all that kind of stuff, they were desperate to find a mission for D-Day which would suit a form of warfare which they didn't really understand. Many in the high command didn't. And so they came up with this idea that they would deploy literally just hours before D-Day itself and drop slightly ahead of the landing beaches and act as a blocking group en masse. So 2,000, which is by now how much the ranks of the SAS had been swollen by recruits. So 2,000 of them would parachute in and basically act in static positions to as the immediate blocking group for the landings. And as Lieutenant Colonel Blair Paddy Main, who was in command of one SAS, and William Stirling, who was in command of two SAS, having taken over from his brother David Stirling when he was captured, said, "That is not how we are used. We're dropped deep behind the lines, small bands of fast-moving raiders to harass and harangue and confound the enemy, and that's how we've always been used, and that's where we do our job best." And Bill Stirling, actually, Colonel Bill Stirling, actually had to fall on his sword and resign in protest at the continued insistence the SAS be used in this way, with the threat of further high-level reservations that eventually High Command gave in. And so a completely new set of missions were conceived of, which were archetypal SAS taskings, dropping deep behind the lines, deep into occupied France, to attack the railways, roads and road convoys carrying German armour, the Panzer divisions, to the D-Day beaches, which we knew is what Hitler would do. As soon as he knew where the landings were, he would rush his heavy armour to those areas to drive the Allies back into the sea. And so the SAS were charged to stop the armour getting through. And scores and scores of patrols were parachuted into France just after D-Day to achieve just that. This was an unprecedented territory in a way, because unlike the North African deserts, you know, France was densely populated, heavily occupied by the Germans, 4 years of occupation at least. You know, it was a very different milieu to be dropping into and theatre. And I suppose one of the upsides was that, of course, via the Special Operations Executive, you know, Churchill's Ministry for Ungentlemanly Warfare, we had good contacts and relations with the French resistance, who Churchill had been urging were armed as a guerrilla army to rise up in the enemy's rear. So the plan was really that, you know, these SAS patrols would parachute in, link up with the resistance, fight alongside them and give them the command and control and extra firepower and the confidence to hit hard. So I suppose that made it slightly less daunting, if you like.
All of your books seem to feature the most remarkable characters, but this particular drop had a real quality to it.
Yeah, so the book focuses down onto one patrol. There are patrol within an operation which was codenamed Operation Gain. It was one of these missions to destroy the German armour. And this patrol of 12 men were codenamed Sabu 70. They were dropped into an area just to the south of Paris, literally 20 miles, no more, to the south of Paris near the town of Douaudon, to sabotage rail links and blow up this massive ammo dump that was situated on the fringe of the rail lines from where ammo was being rushed to the D-Day beaches. And the patrol was led by this fabulous and immensely brave and spirited individual called Captain Patrick Garstin. Now, Garstin had already won an MC in the retreat to Dunkirk in the rear guard. He'd been decorated in the field. He'd then been injured quite seriously trying to get off the D-Day beaches. Miracle, he actually got off alive. He'd then come back to the UK, deployed to North Africa to join the East African campaign, still dogged by his injuries, and was eventually and ominously returned to the UK for final disposal, was what was written in his orders, i.e. to be invalided out of the military. Well, rather than being invalided out of the military, he volunteered for airborne training, trained as a parachutist, and then, after a stint with the Long Range Desert Group, actually volunteered for the SAS. So here you had a man, already won an MC, leading this patrol of 12 SAS deep into France, who actually should not have been in the military at all, let alone undergoing and leading frontline operations. And he was the kind of individual who would only ever lead from the front. That was his nature. And indeed, he did throughout the whole of the operations. And then just to continue the theme, his second in command was a Lieutenant John, nicknamed Rex Vihey, who was actually hailed from Mauritius, which was a British and French colony. His ancestors were from Europe. And Vihey, likewise, had been serving in North Africa, had volunteered for airborne duties, had trained with a parachute regiment and had had a parachuting accident and again had been banned from all further frontline duties. But when he was returned to the UK in early 44, had somehow managed to circumvent that, volunteer for the SAS. And as a fluent French speaker and a fluent English speaker, Vihey was welcomed into the SAS with open arms. So that's just two of the individuals, neither of whom should have been there, both of whom had been invalided out, certainly from frontline duties, but had refused not to serve at the sharpest end possible of operations.
How does this operation go?
So they're deployed initially to sabotage the rail and the ammo dumps, and it is a spectacular and resounding success. There's a corporal, Serge Vachelik, who is actually under Garstin, and he's originally of Czech origin, but a French citizen serving in the Free French SAS. And he walks into Doudin town, finds out where and when the next train is due. The whole patrol moves in at night. They stake it out. They kill the guards on the rail tracks. They plant these fog signals, these special SOE-developed charges which enable a charge to blow up just in front of a train, so ensuring derailment. And then they plant around about 50 separate charges on this massive set of ammo dumps, all with four-hour delays, so they make sure they've got enough time to get away. And then they set up their ambush positions for the train, which duly comes steaming through out of the tunnel, at which stage the fog charges are detonated, the explosives ignite, the train's blown to pieces, and the raiders attack it with their Bren guns and their Sten guns. There's then a massive firefight. And there's another standout individual in the patrol who's from Wigan, a former miner from Wigan, and actually one of David Stirling's SAS originals, who's Corporal Thomas Ginger Jones. And he stands firm on the tracks with a Bren gun firing from the hip, via which he enables the rest to get away. And he escapes also with just a flesh wound. And then, of course, they have a very, very, very angry and very, very vengeful enemy on their trail, especially as 3 hours later, vast series of explosions and all the ammo dumps blow up. And so all out of ammunition, not been able to link up with French resistance, so nowhere where they can go to ground and go into hiding. Garstin calls for rescue. And there was this policy developed before the post-D-Day operations went in that, if necessary, they would try to pluck out patrols using aircraft by airborne means. Now, of course, the SOE had long experience of delivering agents into the field by the Lysander light aircraft and collecting them again. So it was a variation on that theme. So Garstin radios Darvel headquarters and asks for pickup rescue. And the reply he gets is not quite what they expected. It's, yes, we'll come and get you. We'll send in an RAF air crew and they're going to land at Etampes airfield, which is just nearby. Now, Etampes airfield was a very significant Luftwaffe airbase. So significant was it that the Allies had mounted half a dozen very significant bombing raids to try to destroy it over the past few weeks, none of which had been very successful. And so, lo and behold, the Sabre 70 patrol were ordered to make their way to Etampes airbase that night to get rescued from the airstrip by a C-47, a Dakota aircraft flying in with an RAF aircrew, a very brave RAF aircrew, it has to be said, who were determined to pluck them out of there. Quite extraordinary.
Is this a particularly unusual raid, or is this just an operation that you were given this entree into? Do you think there were things like this going on all the time, most of which will now be pretty much forgotten to history?
This is an extraordinary rescue. They're pulled out of that airbase by that C-47 and not under fire, a massive firefight. They fight their way onto the aircraft and they get airborne and get back to the UK. It's an extraordinary rescue. And before getting rescued, indeed, they plant the last of their charges on some of the aircraft on the airstrip to actually blow it up as they fly out of there. But having said that, Dan, there were scores of such missions taking place all across France, SAS and other related units. And you could take any number of them and they would be equally brave and fearsome and diehard. What makes this mission so extraordinary and why I decided to focus on it is what happens to them during their next mission, and which leads on to the whole Nazi hunting operations through 1945 post-war. And it's that combination of factors, that cradle to the grave aspect of this story, which really makes it stand out.
Tell me about what happens later in the war.
They get back to the UK on the C-47, and ironically, bizarrely, but I guess you can understand the reasoning, Lieutenant Colonel Blair Main, who's the commander of 1SAS and very much involved in this mission personally, says to them, look, you've been into a Etampes air base and you've got extracted from there. Well, we want to send you back again to the very same place to destroy it. And the reason being, there have been all these RAF and US Air Force bombing raids. None have been successful. And by the way, when they were being extracted from the airbase, they actually came across these camouflage forests. So if you can imagine trees made out of wood and chicken wire with false leaves stretched over them, there were these camouflage forests, absolutely convincing from the air, which explained why the Allied air raids had scored very few successes, because the aircraft were so well hidden. Well, British intelligence had worked out that Etampes Air Base was one of the first air bases to get the Luftwaffe's first jet fighter, so the first operational jet fighter of the entire war, the Sturmvogel. And so they're sent back in again to destroy the air base and take out some of these groundbreaking aircraft. And they're going to be dropped close by in an area of dense forest at a drop zone at a small village called La Ferté-Alais. And SOE have arranged for them to link up with a band of French resistance fighters on the ground, so they'll have a reception party, in theory. In practice, what's happened is that the SOE, I guess you could say, has been penetrated by the Gestapo. And there's a very wily and canny Gestapo commander in Paris at their headquarters at 84 Avenue Foch called Hans Kiefer, who's defected what they called the Funkspiel, the radio games. And the radio games were, they would capture an SOE agent in France, male or female, hopefully capture their radio kit and their code books and their ciphers, turn that captured agent by obvious means, and then use that agent to play back messages to the UK as if that agent was still freely operating in the field, with the aim of calling in more agents and more airdrops of weaponry and more airdrops of supplies and even cash. And that was the Funkspiel games. And Captain Garstin and his men have very sadly fallen victim to a Funkspiel. So when they fly back in again in July now to deploy to La Ferté-Alais drop zone and then attack Etampes Air Base, actually who's waiting for them on the ground is not the French resistance at all. It's a party of Gestapo from Paris and a body of Waffen SS soldiers in ambush position.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman. And on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California, to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage. Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
I guess there's no getting out of that situation.
Not for most of them, no, unfortunately. So Garstin is the first out, first down. He, as I said, led from the front, as always. Shadowy figure runs up to him, dressed in civilians. He presumes it's a member of the French resistance, and the man does indeed shout out, Vive la France. But as he gets close enough to Garstin to whisper, he says, beware, there are Boche Germans all around. And as he leads Garstin into the trees, the enemy come out of the shadows with their weapons, and Garstin is captured. He tries to break away to warn his men, and they shoot him down, and he's very, very grievously injured. if you could imagine jumping out of a fast-moving Stirling bomber in a 12-man stick, even though you jump very closely together, you would be spread out a long way along the ground. Because of that, the last three parachutists don't land in the open field of the drop zone. They land in the forest. Those three get away for that reason and that reason only. But the rest are all either captured, injured very badly and captured, or killed. And some of them, Ginger Jones in particular, basically fight to the last round, and it's dawn before the last ones are brought in. And then the wounded and those who are without wounds are loaded aboard a truck and driven to Paris. The wounded taken to the Hospital Salpêtrière in Paris, given no treatment whatsoever, and immediately face Gestapo interrogations. And just to give you an idea of how brutal this is, Lieutenant Vihe, who I mentioned earlier, the chap who shouldn't have been there at all because he was invalided out of the war, supposedly, he's been shot three times, once in the spine, and he's paralysed from the waist down. Yet even so, within hours of arriving at the hospital, he's got a Gestapo interrogator at his bedside, beating him around the face and even threatening, if he doesn't talk, to get the surgeons to remove his bullets without anaesthetic. So this is pretty brutal stuff. And what are the Gestapo after? Well, it's two things. They're after obviously finding out what their mission was and where there might be other SAS parties deploying in France. But more importantly, they're after launching another Funkspiel operation. So they want to find out who in their party is in charge of communications, where the radio is, where the cipher books are, so they can try and use the captured SAS men to lure in more and more airdrops to capture more and more operators and individuals. And of course, those able-bodied men who've been captured are then taken to the Gestapo headquarters at Avenue Foch, 84 Avenue Foch. And they then go into horrific torture and questioning to try to find out the self-same things.
How do we know about this?
Well, we know about it from a lot of different sources. I have been so privileged and so fortunate and so honoured in telling this story is the help from the families of those who were there. So I'll just give you some examples. Lieutenant Vihe's family, who are in Mauritius, lovely people, so helpful. Now, I didn't know, of course, when I started researching it, but not only did he write up an account of his war in French, which they sent to me, it's book length, but he kept a notebook all through the war. So even when he was in the field, even on this operation, he kept a notebook, so a diary of his operations. They shared that with me. They shared letters between him and all his family members, between him and the fellow members of his patrol. Jean Garstin, the son of Patrick Garstin, the patrol commander, 1 year old when his father was captured, never got to know his father because Garstin was killed at the end of this capture. But Sean, again, who lives in Nairobi in Kenya, immensely helpful, shared with me the family's memorabilia, photographs, letters, medals, everything they have, you know, that you would bring down from a loft in any normal family situation. And the same across so many other members of the patrol. And without that, it's pretty much almost impossible now to tell these kind of stories. And then finally, I guess, to as the icing on the cake, the still surviving and wonderful SAS veteran Jack Mann, who is in his late 90s, who read a very early draft of the manuscript for me to just check the authenticity and the tone was right and sent me back his handwritten notes in pencil, having read it from cover to cover. You know, you pull a team like that together, you really can capture these stories and bring them back alive, which is what one tries to do.
You mentioned many of them didn't make it back alive. What was the circumstances of their death?
So they're being held in the 184 Avenue Falcon in the hospital, and Kiefer, the head of the Gestapo, contacts Berlin and says, what do I do with them? And Hitler himself gets involved and he sends an order to Kiefer. These men are to be executed. They are to be dressed in civilian clothes, taken to a patch of woodland and killed. Now, Hitler took very personally, as a personal insult to himself and the Reich behind the lines operations, whether it be by the SOE, the OSS, the American equivalent, SAS, commandos, parachutists, whoever. Partly it's because we did launch quite a few assassination operations. Reinhard Heydrich comes to mind in Prague, Czechoslovakia, Operation Anthropoid. The many assassination attempts in North Africa and Europe against Rommel, of course. But there were others too. And Hitler felt these were a personal affront, an insult to himself and his top leaders. And so much earlier than the Sabi 70 patrol's capture, he had authored his commando order under which he gave authority, illegally of course, for any captured commandos that all of them had to be killed and could only be kept alive for long enough for their questioning interrogation by the Gestapo. And so he orders the Garstin and his captured men to similarly be killed. And they are, in early August, forced to dress in civilian clothing. And when they challenge why, they're told there's a prisoner exchange taking place in Geneva, and they're going to be trucked to Geneva to be exchanged with German prisoners being handed over by the British. Of course, very few of them believe it, and especially because as they put the civilian clothing on at gunpoint, some of them can see that these clothes, or some of the clothes at least, already have bullet holes in them. And that evening, they're driven out into a patch of French woodland, and Garstin, who is very, very seriously injured, still has had no treatment for his injuries, but is an extremely honourable man and has believed, you know, Kiefer's assurances that they are going to be subjected to a prisoner exchange. When they're marched into the woodland at gunpoint and begin to get lined up, he realises what's really going to happen. He turns to his men and says, "My God, they're going to shoot us." And he says, "I will stand firm and you guys make a break for it." By which he means, "I'm too injured to get away, but some of you aren't. I'll stand and take the fire and you get away." And that's exactly what happens. As Schnurr, who is the SS commander of the execution squad, pulls out a piece of paper and starts to read out Hitler's execution sentence in German, and then has von Capri, his second in command, translate it into English. As they hear the final word, "sentenced to be shot," Jones and Vaculík, the former miner from Wigan and the Czech Free French SAS man, break free and charge their would-be gunmen, their would-be assassins. And both of them manage to run some distance away before their ill-fitting civilian shoes force them or make them trip up, fall over their own feet. And as both go crashing down, volleys of fire break out, including going over their heads. And it's actually their falling down that saves them. Otherwise, they would doubtless have been shot. Vaculík gets back on his feet and runs again and is pursued by the executioners. And Schnurr, the SS commander, realises that if any of these seven get away, there will be hell to pay for them in Berlin, because it's on Hitler's personal orders that they are supposed to be executed. So the hunt is underway. Jones, meanwhile, lays still and plays dead. And when the gunmen have run off, when the executioners have run off after Vaculík, he gets to his feet, dashes away and manages to hide himself under some leaves. And so those two individuals, Corporals Vaculík and Jones, do escape. And that night and over the next few days, they're both reunited with each other and they link up with the French resistance. And so begins the next chapter of the story, where Vaculík and Jones train and call in arms drops to the local Breslès, that's the name of the nearest town, resistance, in preparation for the American advance, when they will rise up in the enemy's rear and ensure that Breslès is liberated. And that's exactly what they do. But it's interesting, Dan, when they escape that firing squad, and you know, read about the escape, it's miraculous, it's almost unbelievable. When they escape, and when they're asked what drove them on with the bullets at their back, it's not just the animal instinct to survive. It's perhaps even more so, it was the desire to get vengeance and justice for their murdered comrades, because they knew that the other men were getting gunned down where they stood at their backs. And so when they eventually liberate Breslès town, Vaculík and Jones then get in the mayor's car, drive back to the site of their executions, collect bullet cases at the very site where they should have died, and then go to the nearby chateau, the Chateau Parisis Fontaine, where the five who had been gunned down were buried in a mass grave, and they find the location of that mass grave. And so begins this investigation into these war crimes, which, as I say, lasted to 1947 and ends up in vengeance and justice being done. The SAS became more and more aware that, you know, Hitler's commander order must exist, and indeed eventually copies were found, and they knew that hundreds of their men had been captured and disappeared. And so both Main and Colonel Franks vowed that the perpetrators would be hunted down and brought to justice. So they set up an official SAS war crimes investigation team towards the end of the war, dispatched them to France and Germany to investigate. And it was headed up by the peerless and brilliant Major Eric Bill Barkworth, an SAS intelligence officer, fluent German speaker and fearsome interrogator. Any German who met Barkworth knew they had more than met their match. Barkworth takes over a former Nazi official's villa in Gaggenau, the German city near the French border, and together with his second in command, the extremely tough and resilient Dusty Rhodes, his sergeant, they start hunting down the suspects. Now, the problem is this. SAS, as I said earlier, was never particularly popular with some in the high command, some in the establishment, as were some of the other special forces units. And by October 1945, the writing's on the wall and the SAS is formally disbanded, told to destroy all documents and all records and return to their units. That's it. End of the regiment as we knew it. And there are some, a Colonel Main and Colonel Franks, first and foremost, commanders of 1 and 2 SAS, and Winston Churchill himself, voted out of power, but still, of course, extremely powerful and influential, who are determined this will not happen. And so the one thing they keep alive, and they are determined to keep alive at all cost, is the Nazi hunting team. And so the SAS war crimes investigation team goes dark. It goes completely unofficial. It becomes known as the Secret Hunters. They're funded out of a black budget, massaged out of the War Office, so the War Office isn't aware where the money's actually going, and they're controlled by a clandestine radio set perched on the roof of a building in Eaton Square, which gives them their orders from London, and it's a completely off-the-books operation. Amazingly, they recruit more SAS to it, and they are hiding in plain sight, so they're operating the length and breadth of Europe, of former German-occupied Europe. They're driving old SAS jeeps. They're wearing the SAS cap badge, the wind beret. They're dressed in uniform. They are masquerading as if they have every right to be there. And indeed, they are one of the most successful war crimes hunting operations ever. And they are, in large part, because, Dan, they're willing to break all the rules. You know, they don't seek permission when they are crossing from one zone of occupation to another, because they know if they seek permission, then a warning might get through to the man they're after. They use their jeeps and the back roads, they circumvent the checkpoints, they arrive on the suspect's doorstep in the middle of the night unannounced, and they address him in his pyjamas or his underpants. These are snatch missions, and they're extremely successful. The culprits are dragged back to the Villa Degla basement, and there they are interrogated by Barkworth, and very few, if any, don't break very, very quickly. And it's in that process that Barkworth realises there is this individual, Hans Kiefer, the chief of the Gestapo from Paris, who then came back through the Vosges Mountains to Strasbourg as Nazi Germany forces retreated from the Allies, and that he is responsible for scores of atrocities against captured Allied agents, SAS, SOE, including those wanted for what became known as the No Allies Wood killings, the killings of our SABU 70 patrol, Garstin and his men. And it's a strange thing because at the end of the war, the SS itself was rightly made an illegal organisation, and any SS were slated for arrest and questioning and potentially trial. And so Kiefer and his second in command, Haug and others, know that they're being sought, and so they go into hiding. And Kiefer and Haug go to a Bavarian ski resort and get casual jobs as hotel cleaners, and that's where they're going to hide out. But Haug, who has five children, decides one day he cannot not go and visit his family. And Kiefer warns him, if you go home, they're going to be watching, you'll get captured and you may give me away. Haug goes anyway, and lo and behold, Barkworth's men are watching. They arrest Haug. And in questioning, Haug, who'd been held as a prisoner of war by the British during World War I, he's an old soldier and was treated very well, so whose allegiances are torn anyway, Haug confesses all. And he says, I think you might find Kiefer, who's their number one wanted, in this ski resort in Bavaria. And in that way, all of the suspects who haven't been killed in the war are brought into custody, give their confessions and stand trial at Wuppertal in the summer of 1947, and they're all sentenced either to death or to long custodial sentences. So the justice and the vengeance which Ginger Jones and Serge Vachelik sought as they escaped has finally been served.
Good luck. The book is called?
SAS, Band of Brothers.
Boom. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
Hi, everybody. Just a quick message at the end of this podcast. I'm currently sheltering in a small, windswept building on a piece of rock in the Bristol Channel called Lundy. I'm here to make a podcast. I'm here enduring weather that, frankly, is apocalyptic, because
I want to get some great podcast material for you guys. In return, I've got a little tiny favor to ask. If you could go to wherever you get your podcasts, if you could give it a 5-star rating, if you could share it, if you could give it a review, I really appreciate that. Then from the comfort of your own homes, you'll be doing me a massive favor. Then more people will listen to the podcast. We can do more and more ambitious things, and I can spend more of my time getting pummeled. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.